Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving you.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Augmented reality, virtual reality, and the future of the city.
I did my first ride with the Oculus Rift and a laptop attached to the coaster, actually with some duct tape. It was just an experiment, and it was life-changing.
Thomas Wagner will tell us about adding virtual reality to a roller coaster. And what does Pokemon Go tell us about tech's role in the city of tomorrow? First, though, the city of today and retrofitting that city. That was the band Prophets of Rage performing at Cleveland's newly redesigned public square. They were singing, sort of, but some people are speaking in half-hour slots they've booked at a speaker's platform. Others are just showing up to protest, such as this activist who refers to himself as Antonio G. He was wearing a large poncho painted to look like a brick wall with the words, "Wall off Trump."
Yes, so I'm from Chicago, Illinois. I came all the way to Cleveland. And I'm here at Public Square right now to recruit more people for tomorrow's action. We're going to be meeting here at Public Square to send this message of "Wall off Trump" and letting know Trump that we don't want his wall.
This park, redesigned at a cost of $50 million through a private-public partnership, actually has roots that date back to the birth of American democracy.
Public Square has been assigned by the city the role of being a place for public speakers, as there was back in the late 19th century where, you know, President McKinley and Horace Greeley and others once spoke in this area.
This is Colin Woodard, a contributing editor at Politico magazine.
Now there's a stage there again, and people have been signing up for half-hour chunks of time to be able to sort of address the public from this stump. So it's playing some sort of oratorical role for those who aren't in the convention itself.
Woodard spearheads the What Works series on successful innovations in cities for Politico magazine. His latest article is called "The Hot New Park at the Center of the Republican Convention."
Public Square is sort of at the heart of Cleveland, right in the middle of the city. And when the city was first laid out in 1796 in the New England model, Public Square was literally the New England-style town common right in the center of what was then a village, where you would come and bring your cattle and your sheep and stuff to graze. So it was always intended to be the heart of the city, and then it became, as the city grew, a battleground between those who wanted it to be essentially a transit hub and those who wanted it to be a civic space, ultimately a park.
And most recently, the struggle for it to be a public space has won out. Tell us about the new public space.
Yes, very recently, only since 2010 or so, because for a very long time, from the 1860s, after a great war known as the Fence War about the future of the square, essentially the square has been cut into four quadrants by busy roads. It's an enormous intersection, a center of the public transit system. Built next door is the railway terminal, on top of which was the largest skyscraper at the time it was built in the 1930s in the world outside New York City. So it was a big hub. It had become, you know, dirty, unpleasant, absolutely not a destination, a place Clevelanders, you know, avoided. You got off your train or you made your connection and you got away from there. And it wasn't until the spring of 2010 that some people came forward within the mayor's office with this idea of that was not serving the city well, and that redoing this public space and doing it in such a way that would knit it and the city back together, knit it to these enormous public spaces created by the famous landscape architect Daniel Burnham in a grand plan from 1903, that they would reconceive Public Square to help knit the city's civic spaces back together and create sort of the glue or the adhesive to, you know, make downtown Cleveland great again.
So to remake this public space, they turned to a landscape architect who's achieved a lot of acclaim in recent years. He's called James Corner. His firm is James Corner Field Operations. In LA, we have a park designed by James Corner. It's the Tongva Park in Santa Monica. He most notably was the landscape design partner in the team that created the High Line in Manhattan. So James comes in to design this park in Cleveland.
Correct. You know, originally, the challenge was when Corner was first asked to come in back in sort of 2002, when another organization was sort of kicking the tires. The problem was that the city insisted that the square had to continue to be bisected by these two busy avenues. And it wasn't until 2010 when the mayor's office got involved and they commissioned a bigger traffic study that took a wider view that the technocrats basically figured out, no, you could actually close off the streets. And that really freed up James Corner and his team to design a public space that people could really use, that unified the whole area with a green and sort of these looping walkways and spaces for stages, and really made it back into a place people would actually like to gather rather than just get away from.
That was Colin Woodard, contributing editor at Politico magazine. And here's Cleveland resident Pearl Reed telling KCRW's Saul Gonzalez why the park means so much to her and the city.
We need this. We definitely needed it.
Why? It's a beautiful city. There are other places to go.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place, but because people come from different areas, and it's a great place for people to come from east side, the west side, to just kind of meet up.
It kind of unites Cleveland.
Yeah, it's kind of that connecting spot. Yes.
Black, white, rich, poor.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Everybody comes down here. Everyone.
I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Now into the unreal, real world. In a moment, yes, Pokemon Go, and how augmented reality might play a role in cities built by techies. First up, though, let's get a dose of virtual reality on what is already an extreme real-world experience, a roller coaster. Wearing VR goggles and flying through an alternative universe while being hurtled round the loop-de-loop, does that sound crazy to you? Well, this is the new trend in roller coaster design, and one of the first places to test it is our very own Six Flags Magic Mountain. There, the 1976 Revolution coaster has been remade into the New Revolution virtual reality coaster, all by adding some goggles. Let's start with someone who's ridden it, KCRW's Eric J. Lawrence. He literally just got off the ride as we reached him by cell, and it turns out he did not throw up. Eric, how do you feel?
I'm doing good. It was a long journey, but ultimately a rewarding one.
So tell us about the ride.
So the ride itself is pretty thrilling, all things told. The thing that is amazing about the VR technology, once you put the goggles on, and the goggles are all immersive, they cover your entire eyes, you can't really see anything else, and when you first sit down and get into the coaster itself, it's like a hangar bay with a jet fighter that you're in. And if you look around, you can see a bunch of other jets that are looking like they're getting fitted to take off. And they give you some instructions in terms of how to shoot at aliens that you're going to be apparently fighting as you go on this. But the thing that is amazing about it is because no matter what you have seen while waiting in line, the fact that you're going to go up this hill and then you're going to go down and you're going to go upside down and so on, you can't anticipate when that's happening in the course of the actual ride. So when it drops, you have no idea when it's going to stop dropping. It just feels like it could drop forever. And eventually it pulls up and it makes turns, but you can't anticipate those turns either. It really is a bit nerve-wracking in the sense that you feel very much like you're in open space. So it really does kind of take you out of the sense that you're in a machine that is actually moving forward versus something that's in open space.
But it also takes you out of the experience you have in a video game where you are controlling the plane.
That's right. For the most part, yeah, you are totally at the mercy of what you would be in just sort of an open space setting and trying to dodge all of these obstacles. And it does greatly up the adrenaline when you don't have those very clear clues ahead of you in terms of what's going to be happening next.
But really, ultimately, the question is, was it worth it, or is a regular roller coaster ride quite exciting enough?
it is something worth experiencing, and certainly for someone that is a roller coaster fan, certainly the enthusiast is going to want to try it. This is clearly the wave of the future for a lot of amusement parks, and the way that they retool some of their older rides, it is absolutely something worth experiencing.
Well, Eric J. Lawrence, thank you for an arduous expedition on behalf of KCRW.
It was my pleasure.
That's KCRW's Eric J. Lawrence. And in case you're wondering, yes, the goggles are cleaned and sanitized between each ride. In fact, according to Eric, that added quite a bit of time to the wait. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. The simulation on the New Revolution virtual reality coaster was created by a German company named VR Coasters. Incidentally, the original Revolution ride was built by German company ride manufacturer Anton Schwarzkopf to a design by Werner Stengel, also German. VR Coasters is providing the same service to many other Six Flags locations and other parks. By the end of this year, they expect 20 parks to be using their VR technology. So why did they feel the need to intensify a ride that is already quite exciting enough? We reach CEO Thomas Wagner in his office in Kaiserslautern, Germany.
Yes, roller coasters are exciting, of course, but actually what we are doing is we have been creating basically an entirely new kind of attraction. What we do for the first time, the setup that we created for the first time allows for a simulation ride to have continuous G-forces, zero gravity, real airtime, real drops. You never had that in a classic simulator. And for the first time, this virtual reality simulation gets combined with the real notion of airtime and drops and G-forces.
So you're saying this is a cost-efficient way for a theme park to update its experiences?
Yes, it is not only cost-efficient, it's also much quicker to do than to build an entire roller coaster, a new roller coaster. And we can integrate ride elements that haven't been there before in this coaster. So for instance, if you go through a curve element, we can tilt the track in this curve even more until we go to an entire inversion and you have a corkscrew element, although the real coaster doesn't have that. But in virtual reality, you actually buy it and you think you're going upside down.
But doesn't that suggest that perhaps one doesn't even need to go on the coaster at all? One can just have a VR experience that takes you up and down and does loops and everything you've just described.
Well, there was kind of a big hype for virtual reality coaster simulations when the Oculus Rift came out and everybody was trying that. But everybody was very quickly getting sick because what your inner sense of balance feels does not match what you see. And this is something that is totally different when you are sitting in the actual coaster. And the simulation is synchronized precisely to the actual ride on the real coaster track.
Now, Thomas, I read from your bio, in addition to being CEO of VR Coaster, you're also a professor at the University of Applied Sciences. I imagine this must be an incredibly fun application of science.
Yes, actually, it is. And it has been starting as this kind of experiment that you do with your students, you know. When the Oculus Rift came out, I was thinking, okay, what subject, what task should I assign to my students? I want to do something with virtual reality because this is the next big thing and it's easy to do and it's low cost with the Oculus Rift. And I was thinking, okay, so everybody's going for virtual reality coaster simulations. I am a coaster fan or enthusiast, if you will. I was approaching Mack Rides, which is a renowned German roller coaster manufacturer. And there we made our first experiments. And we saw that not only it works very well, but it's just amazing. I remember when we did the first rides, I did my first ride with the Oculus Rift and a laptop attached to the coaster, actually with some duct tape. It was just an experiment. It was life-changing. I never had any experience before that came even close to this setup that we had back then.
Not even being on a roller coaster?
Well, I like roller coasters and I loved going on roller coasters, but it's totally different.
I'm talking to you at the end of a couple of weeks which has seen Pokemon Go become a worldwide phenomenon. Now, Pokemon Go is an example of augmented reality. What you're working with is virtual reality, but is there some connection in terms of this way in which people are seeking intensified experiences within the realm of reality?
I think that it has a lot in common. When you talk about virtual reality, of course, this is just an encapsulated simulation. You don't see anything from the real world. And then there are these different levels of simulation, like the augmented reality or mixed reality, what we have with the Pokemon. We have the Microsoft HoloLens, which is basically mixed reality. So you get something copied into your own vision. I think all these aspects have been around for quite a long time. And now this reaches our world. This reaches what you see with your own eyes. And this is something, yeah, it's kind of a breakthrough. We didn't have these levels of reality being touched by what was a game before, you know. And I think this is what made augmented reality and virtual reality so... So spectacular at the moment.
That was Thomas Wagner, founder and CEO of VR Coasters. I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Coming up after this break, augmented reality and how it might shape cities as Silicon Valley companies get in the game of city planning.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Of all the international news that has shaken us these last few days, perhaps the least vital is the fact that Pokemon Go crashed this weekend, just as 26 countries joined the game. But the digital treasure hunt game app has become a global phenomenon bigger than, yes, well, Candy Crush Saga. As you know, millions and millions of people have been wandering the streets into the wee hours in search of Pikachu. Some players have wound up in very unexpected real situations. One player found a dead body, another got himself stabbed. Two men fell off a bluff while playing. But some city watchers say that an unintended consequence is that people are suddenly engaging with their surroundings in a new way. Is this a good thing? And what does it say about what Silicon Valley might have in store as it gets involved in city building? Alyssa Walker is the new urbanism editor for Curbed.
There's been a lot of hope, I think, from a lot of the people who work in technologies in cities about how virtual reality and augmented reality and the cityscape can work together. And there was a game that is kind of the predecessor to Pokemon Go called Ingress, which I've played for many years. A lot of people have been really into it, which is a very similar game, but it hadn't really taken off the way that Pokemon Go has taken off. So now we have I think almost 21 million daily users of the app of Pokemon Go who are walking around their cities, who are interacting with other people, who are pointing their phones at these public murals and public art and really experiencing their cities in a totally different way. And this is something that, like, people who work at the intersection of technology and city spaces have really been trying to crack. How do you develop this game layer, for example, that kind of lays over the city, that provides different information, that maybe gets people more engaged in enjoying their city and using their city? And there's apps that maybe you can hold up and see a building, you know, what building used to exist there before. You could hold it up and there might be some history that pops up, or there might be a little, you get a little notification on your phone when you cross a very important historical marker in your city. But to actually get people setting out on purpose to go explore their cities and use this augmented reality, it's something that people have been talking about for a long time, and it actually seems to be happening now.
Do you think it could last, though? I mean, definitely the Pokemon Go thing feels like one of those crazes that just sort of sprung up overnight. And does it sustain itself?
I mean, there's two things I say when people ask if, you know, well, of course, this is just another app and then we'll forget about it in a few weeks is what everybody says. But there's two things I say to look at. First is we already interact with a lot of game layers, I'm making quotes, air quotes, on our phones as the world exists now. For, like Google Maps and the way that, you know, things are plotted on Google Maps as you go through your city, that's giving you a completely different way to see how far away you are from coffee or if there is a, you know, transit station around the corner or maybe you could walk there in a place that you didn't know was that far away. Also, things like Waze actually started as a game. So the reason they designed it that way was to get people to kind of drive down these streets and chomp up these little dots, much like a Pac-Man going through your city. And that's how they got people to engage with the app and to feed it the data that it needed to be such a robust way to get around town. So we're already kind of playing these games and we already are kind of using this augmented reality technology, even if you're not thinking about it. The other thing is that a lot of groups are taking advantage of the fact that people want to come search for Pokemon creatures, whatever you call them, in their parks and landmarks and public spaces. So the National Parks Service is doing like walks where you can go hunt for them. And there's like a lot of tourist sites in LA are trying to capitalize on it. Metro has its own Twitter account set up just for Pokemon play to kind of give people hints at ones that are by subway stations or something. There's an Expo Line guide, for example. So I think it's still getting people out and to interact with other people. And it's also just teaching the importance of a very dense, walkable community. That's the best Pokemons to find are, you know, located in very close proximity to together in a place that is a little bit more dense and walkable. So maybe in the back of your head, it's teaching you that that's a better place to be.
Maybe. Let's just pivot for just one moment to say the Broad Museum. The Broad Museum is extraordinarily popular with the so-called millennials. It's become an Instagram craze to stand in front of a painting at the Broad and send out a selfie in front of the painting. But one of the complaints I've heard from people who sort of know art is they're not interested in the art. Well, ditto for the National Park Service that, you know, you're chasing Pokemon characters in the national park. Might you even bother to really stop to sort of contemplate that marvelous outcrop? You know, might you, does it engage you with the park in a way that the park keepers would really ideally want you to be engaged?
I mean, you are hearing some funny stories about people who were going to maybe inappropriate monuments like the Holocaust Memorial and trying to capture Pokemon, which is, I think, kind of problematic, and they have to be sensitive about where the spots are located. But I have to say that from what I'm hearing from people, even people who've lived in LA for a long time, that using the app is almost like a great – you don't even have to play, but you can look for spots near you to find murals. And, you know, it does give a description of the mural, so you might find out a little bit of history. But I also just think getting people out and walking around, you can't say that's a bad thing. I mean, there's a lot of people who have said that they are getting more exercise and finding different parts of their cities and their neighborhoods. There was a tweet from Jawbone, who makes one of the fitness trackers. They make a bunch of different fitness trackers that people wear on their wrists, that said that people who had the app had like skyrocketed in the amount of steps over that first week and then it was out. So the data is out there. Like, if people are using this game, they are getting exercise. They are getting out there. They are definitely seeing something and becoming connected to their city.
We've been talking about augmenting the reality of cities that actually exist. Let's just pivot quickly to the ways in which the tech community is engaging with the idea of not just cities that exist, but new cities. You've written about this research project emanating from this VC company that supports startups called Y Combinator. They've put out this call for ideas for the future city. Tell us about Y Combinator and what they're trying to accomplish.
So Y Combinator is this incubator in Silicon Valley that brings startups to their Silicon Valley headquarters and gets them seed funding and kind of puts them through this training to grow them into these massive tech companies. And some of them are very famous that you would know. I think the biggest one that everybody is probably familiar with is Airbnb. And to me, that was a very interesting thing for Y Combinator to be exploring this new cities, smart cities phenomenon. I should say, a lot of different companies, tech companies, are talking about the smart city and building a city from scratch or layering their technology over the city. For example, Alphabet/Google's Sidewalk Labs has been rumored to be working on a similar kind of project, and they're very engaged in this city tech, everything from helping transit companies to creating these kind of Wi-Fi kiosks in cities that can allow people to get online. And of course, it's not a new idea for companies to want to build cities. There's everything from Port Sunlight in that was a lever company town in the UK, the Pullman Utopias that were created in Chicago. And I remember like the Domino's Pizza founder built a city from scratch in Florida. So none of these are new ideas. But I think there's this idea that tech companies can somehow solve problems better than the civic organizations that we're familiar with. And it's interesting that Y Combinator is doing this kind of project because many would argue that Airbnb, its most famous investment, has been ruining the cities that people
disruptive,
have
destroyed communities through taking thousands of rentals off the market. And especially ironic because Y Combinator, as part of its mandate in terms of this call for ideas, is think about the smart city, think about self-driving cars, etc., but also think about affordable housing.
Right.
We're going to make our focus affordable housing.
Right. It just struck me as very funny. And I was, you know, just kind of laughing. Well, okay, if you're talking about affordable housing, all the tech companies that you have funded have probably displaced very many people who are living in San Francisco. Maybe we should just build those people a place to live first before we're building a city from the ground up.
But bottom line is Silicon Valley is engaging with physical space in a way that it didn't at its outset.
Yeah, I mean, I think the autonomous vehicle portion of it is a very critical part because there's a lot riding on how these will transform our cities and how where does the technology end and where does the planning of the physical space need to meet it? Because what's going to happen with autonomous vehicles and Google and Tesla and all these are very good examples is that we won't need car ownership in the way that we do now. We'll have more space for our parking lots to be transformed into potentially affordable housing. And these are a lot of the ideas that are being discussed out there. And so, of course, the tech companies need to step up and start proposing those solutions because they're going to be part of this change. And it's going to happen very fast, whether or not people think that it's going to happen very fast. So for someone like Google to have something like Sidewalk Labs proposing solutions for how to fix that, I think that's a very responsible and good thing for them to do.
That was Alyssa Walker, urbanism editor at Curbed. She recently projected life in a future LA in a letter from 2056, Utopian LA is where everyone wants to live, just published in the LA Times. And Y Combinator is looking for ideas to fund from people with, quote, strong interests and bold ideas in architecture, ecology, economics, politics, technology, urban planning, and much more. Their deadline is the end of this month. You're listening to DNA. Tom Dixon is one of Britain's most prolific independent creators of furniture, lighting and interiors. He's famed for an idiosyncratic style and a philosophy that he credits to being self-taught.
Well, I was a musician and I was involved in a nightclub business. I had a lot of spare time during the day. I learned to weld, and welding was like a superpower. You know, it allowed me to make huge structures very quickly, strong structures. And I immediately started to make furniture for my own pleasure. And then people started buying it. And so I do think that the punk music movement taught anybody that had been attached to that that they could do things without a certificate, do things without 5 years of study, just by having a very strong attitude. I mean, the Sex Pistols at the time were number one in the charts. They had no airplay. They didn't know how to play their instruments. They couldn't sing. But they had a very strong attitude and were a success because of that.
That's Tom Dixon. We'll run more from that interview on a later show, but if you'd like to hear him talk in person, come to his showroom in the platform development at Culver City Expo Line Station Thursday night. I'll be talking with him. See details in our weekly 5 Design Things to Do This Week post at kcrw.com/DNAblog. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's show. Avishai Artsy is DNA's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jenny Hamill, Sol Gonzalez, Jason Groman, and Stephanie Case. Thank you very much for listening.